This stuff is too good to not get on. Well, we're recording now. Welcome everyone to Human Centered Security. I'm your host, Heidi Trost, and we were just talking about emojis and how I have with me Darren Thomas and Margaret Cunningham from Weathos. So, put you on the spot, Margaret, what is your favorite emoji?
I
She's,
really
are you on
like,
mute? How did this just not
no, I mean,
mute?
this is a really hard question. I like Party Blob.
Oh, yes, party
I really
blob.
like Party Blob. I'm gonna have to go with that one.
What about you?
I think, well, the one I use the most, and it's normally when I've messed something up, is the grimace emoji. That's kind of my get out of jail free card. When I've made a little bit of a mess up, I put that at the end.
Use this one frequently, is what you're saying.
That's my most frequent use.
So I did create an emoji that's only in use in one place, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the safety dance song, like, we can dance if we want to.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, it has a really, really
I mean, you can sing
insane.
it if you want.
I'm not going
I don't
to.
think anybody has actually sang on the podcast, but feel free.
I'm not going to break that seal because no one will listen ever again. But I deployed a new security solution and I created a safety dance emoji from the music video. And that honestly might have been like my emoji claim to
It's
fame.
your contribution to the world. Just in case anybody was wondering, this is a podcast about emojis. And since no one asked, no one cares, my favorite emoji is typing cat. So, actually, I invited Darren and Margaret on here for a specific reason, and that was to talk about Weathos. It was to talk about security by design, which hopefully is just as exciting as emojis, but I kind of am not sure. So, Margaret, why don't you start us off? Tell us a little bit about yourself, briefly describe what Weathos does and is.
Sure. So I joined Weathos as the chief scientist. I have a background in security and a PhD in experimental psychology. So I've kind of a bit of a blend across different domains. And Weathos is an amazing platform. It's all about people. It just so happens that everybody on our leadership team has an, very, very extensive background in security. So ultimately, we have this space to help people connect with each other, to help people perform in groups and teams, and to kind of find their best fit within their company and within their role that highlights their strengths. With that comes a lot of data and a lot of personal stuff because we believe that we can help people make better interpersonal connections. So I won't go too far down that road. But you can imagine we have a lot of things to think about. I don't know, Darren, you want to jump in and intro yourself?
Yeah, sure. No, that's a great intro there, Margaret. So yeah, been with Weathos. It's actually might even be my year's anniversary today, or close to it. I'm the chief product officer here. I also, like the rest of the leadership team, have a deep background in security, and I've been doing that for many years. I think we're going to be talking about some of that kind of during the podcast and how we're applying that here to people. But as Margaret mentioned, our platform is it's really for everyone. It's for people to help them understand themselves better, understand their team better, work together more effectively. But we do need to be very conscious and responsible and careful about how we treat that data. So even though it might seem like a little bit of an odd leap in terms of security folks getting together and doing this, I think baking it into the DNA of the product is going to be critical for us and making sure that we respect the data that we're collecting and we treat it accordingly.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in and say that Margaret was actually on the podcast before. She was one of the very few first few folks that I talked to, and she talked about human factors in security. It was an amazing episode. I will link to it in the show notes, but just wanted to give Margaret a shout out. I'm hoping that Maybe Darren, you want to dive into this a little bit. Why would someone use Wethos? What is the purpose? Just to kind of give folks some context.
Sure. No, be happy to. So what Wethos is a way of understanding your natural work styles, your natural behaviors, not just of yourself, but also of teams that you're on, people that you need to work with, and putting it all in context. And really think of Wethos as your personal coach or co-pilot to navigate you through the workplace. So maybe you have a tricky meeting coming up with somebody, and you want to know how best to prepare for it. So by understanding yourself, understanding the other person or people, if you're meeting with multiple, and really getting that guidance on how to not only prepare for that tricky meeting, but also how to conduct the meeting. Like, what are some of the key things that you can do to your behavior to adjust so your message is heard a little bit better and resonates well with the audience? So everything that we do is all around understanding people, the dynamics between different people and different teams, but more importantly, putting all of that into context. It's kind of very, very different guidance if you're having a brainstorming meeting to create a new company versus a website has a series of bugs in it that we need to fix. So context is key for everything that we do here, but it is all anchored on understanding people.
You know, you had this unique opportunity to build something from scratch, building in security from the very beginning. How did you approach it differently compared to maybe some of the or other organizations that you've worked with?
Yeah, I mean, I think it having that blank piece of paper is both very exciting and presents a lot of opportunities, but it can be daunting as well. So I think that talks to the background of the team and also the engineering team that that we've put together here. And like, we know what's coming. So in terms of we've all dealt with large enterprises, we know kind of broadly the questions that that we're going to have. There is an additional layer that we have here because we're dealing with people. So we do have to also put in that additional layer of making sure that we are doing the right thing. So what it allowed us to do was to make sure that we were doing it right from the start. So segregation of data, anonymizing data, making sure that from the get-go our users can opt out, can delete their data as they see fit. But building the architecture and the infrastructure where we're not going to be hating ourselves 6 months down the line when we have to rework it in order to kind of untangle some spaghetti data that we've put in there. Now, there is a balance there because we also have to be very nimble and move fast, but we do have an eye on the future. We know where we want to take the business, where the business is going to go. So we also have, even at this super early stage, half an eye on SOC 2 compliance and some of those other things that when we're dealing with the very largest of enterprises that are going to come down for us. We also have a diverse team in terms of background. So we have a pretty deep understanding of the European markets with GDPR and things like that. So, like, all of those things are factored in. And even if we don't have them in from the get-go, we make sure that the design will scale with it and the architecture will allow for it when we're at the point where we need to implement some of these things. So it really was a ground-up design, making sure that, yes, we meet the requirements and the standards, the high standards that we set for ourselves. But also we can grow into it in the future when, say, SOC 2, I use that example, but when that comes. And that's like, we all know these things happen faster than you think they will. We're going to find that key customer that absolutely needs it, and we've just got to make sure that we're in a position where we're ready for things like that.
You mentioned balancing, wanting to build it right from the beginning and build it with, SOC in mind, for example, but also needing to be able to be nimble and to build quickly. Can you provide an example or just give us a sense of what you mean or how you overcome, one of those trade-offs?
Sure. So, like, some of the things, we might not surface on the front end immediately, but we know we can get to it. So, for example, Customers are very keen on auditability and like who did this and who did that. Now, with a product that's been out there for a while, there's many ways to kind of get to that data, and oftentimes it surfaces in the product. So we make decisions like that where we wouldn't necessarily like surface that audit log and make it searchable and filterable in the front end. But if a customer came to us and said, "Hey, I need to know that," we have an answer because we can get to it. So I think it's making some of those trade-offs, like would we rather have a searchable audit log, or would we really want this killer feature where we can surface insights into what biases the team you're working on might have, for example. So we trade that way, knowing that we have an answer if somebody really, really wanted to get an info. So I think that's probably the example that's top of most of mind.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think, Darren, you said this in a previous conversation. You said when you have a security background, you can actually be more creative. And I really liked that, but I was hoping you could expand on what you meant by this.
Yeah, and I think part of that is kind of knowing what are the non-negotiables, I guess, in terms of set standards that either industry sets for us or we set for ourselves. But also knowing what the negotiables are in terms of balancing that user experience with the security concerns in mind. So we've been backwards and forwards here a little bit on our onboarding process, for example, for new customer signups. And we've looked, we've worked with our UX designer. We've worked kind of internally for different feedback. And it might be a little bit of a dry example, but we looked at, okay, well, how does a new user get into our product? So we send them.
Onboarding is never a dry example, by the way.
Oh, okay. All right. Good. Good. All
Yeah.
right. So good. I got a. Got a captive audience for a moment, so I'll take advantage. We have our UX designer, in meetings with all of us with security in mind. That's like, well, okay, well, when I first sign up and I create a new password, should I then auto log into the product after creating the password, or do we need a step like in the middle that then has me put in my email address and password again? Now, security-wise, that's better. UX-wise, it's like one more thing, and if you don't have a password manager, we force, of course, strong passwords. So then you type it in once, and then you're like, "Oh no, what was that? I only typed it in a few seconds ago, but now I can't remember." And now you're in the reset password process. So, it's making sure that our security folks are on board, and we patch any potential gaps in that process so that we can give the best customer experience. And that is where I think having that combination of UX and security engineers talking to each other. I mean, it sounds, I know you said it's not dry to you, Heidi, which I appreciate. But it's just like little things like that that are
Yeah. Well, because
pretty.
you think they're little things, but then they turn into these big user experience issues. One designer told me sign up was like first impressions, right? Like it's my first impression of your product. And she was telling me how disappointed she was that their first impressions were not that great. So that kind of stuck with me. Like it is the first impression. So if you don't get it right, if you don't think about those little things, then you potentially have a poor user experience.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why we're really conscious. And for UX for us, I mean that was pretty much one of our first hires. I know we'll maybe chat about that a bit later, but it's so important, especially at this stage of our evolution as well, that UX is and UI is factored into everything we do.
I have
Yeah.
completely abandoned a product or a vendor or whatever because their logins are messy. Like I've just been like, never mind. No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
So,
that that's a common thing, right?
yeah, and it's noticeable when it goes well.
Yeah, Darren, you just mentioned that you work really collaboratively with your UX designer. What does that process look like?
So, we have a lot of ideation in the company. A lot of us, especially at this early stage, are pretty abstract in the thinking. But I think as part of that, it means a lot of us are visual. So a lot of times when we come up with the new feature or a new idea, and you know we spend time explaining it to ourselves. Oftentimes, we will get in a room with the UX designer, and our one is great because our UX designer can get to kind of medium fidelity designs in about the same pace that a lot can get to low fidelity. So it kind of helps. Low fidelity designs are great, by the way, because you iterate like super fast. But if you can just like notch it to that, you know, quick kind of medium fidelity design, it then really starts to resonate, and that allows us to really get kind of the whole company involved in that creative process as well. The other thing that we've done with our last couple of features is we've actually got it kind of working with product mocks. Like directly in product itself, so that we can look at the flow. So not necessarily the design, maybe not looking great, but so that we can look at the flow. So that's been a pretty interesting process from us as sort of moving from sort of the Figma world and iterating on designs, that we've now got a way of fast prototyping in product with a framework that we use, where we can just kind of get these flows in quickly and go, oh, that didn't quite work. And again, that's very collaborative with our designer as well, that we can get kind of the real world flows through, and then kind of go back and go, all right, well, now we like this flow, we don't like that flow, or we like this leading to that, then go back and do the designs. But it's been highly collaborative all the way throughout, and I think that's what's enabled us to move so fast as well.
Yeah, are you I'm going to go on a tangent here just be for my own knowledge. What are you using? Is that something that like you homegrown, like you made it, or is that a tool that you use? How do you do
Yeah.
that?
So I mean, for the actual designs, we use Figma, but to actually get them in the product, we have a you know pretty standard framework that we use that enables us to build UI components quickly. So we use for our prototypes, at least, we use a theme. So you know we don't have to spend a day designing a button; we can just kind of grab it. But it enables us to like plot at least the screen movement and get it all hooked up so it flows through. You know, using dummy data to start with, of course. But the fact that we have a modular framework in the product as well allows us to do that quick, and then we can just go and style it over the top once we're happy with the design.
Yeah, I think, and this is kind of aside from security, but it's interesting to kind of talk to someone who's entrenched in the startup world and like how iterative and how collaborative it is. And something that often comes up in the products that I work with is, can we just build something that at least like folks can play around with it and start to understand like what is working and what's not working? Like the days of the static prototypes are, it just like slows things down so ridiculously,
Yeah, no, I agree. And then kind of layered with that as well is, you know, if you have feature flags, you know, you can then roll it out to either like different people internally, or if you've got, you know, friendly customers that we're very thankful for that we have, you know, we can say, hey, like this is, you know, a little experimental for us, but you know, we can enable it just for you, and you know, we'd love your feedback. So again, I think that goes back, Heidi, a little bit, not so much security, but just like getting those fundamentals in to start with, it gives you then a lot of flexibility to experiment.
So Heidi, I happen to know some of the behind the scenes things that you wouldn't know that you may like to hear a little bit more about. And
Yes,
since
please.
with this is about people, and I love the idea that we are not trying to make people work for their technology. We really need to have technology that's built for people, to help people hit their peak performance, help them, with whatever they have in their brain, what's left for the day, like how much attention, how much memory. Like, this should be making stuff easier for people. But like, we care so deeply about individual people at Wethos that some of the things that we've built in are slightly unique, especially when it comes to visibility and access. And I think, Darren, we sort of chatted about this the other day, Darren, about how it's a little bit different, right? Like, a a lot of enterprise software, you go in, there's like some super admin, they set it up, they turn things on, they turn things off, they let people do things or they don't, they let people see things or they don't. And all of those controls, beautiful, wonderful, great. But because the point of this product is to create connections and to allow people to learn and grow and join the team and understand where they are and see all of this stuff, Darren did not do the entire access control and visibility strategy for a super admin. We made the choice to put, a large degree of this in the hands of individual users. And so, I don't know, Darren, if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I think that's super unique and super powerful for people, and I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate bringing that up because this is a little controversial, I think, but in a good way. So I guess to contextualize some of that, I mean, sort of traditionally with RBAC, I mean, let's say that you block visibility. I don't know, between sales and engineering, right? Two
RBAC
separate.
is role-based access control, just for anyone who doesn't know what that means.
Yes, sorry. Yeah,
That's okay.
should have clarified. All right. Yes, exactly. So role-based access control. So, I'm in engineering. I don't interface with sales often. So, like in terms of the company structure, there's like visibility constraints around that. So, which makes sense in a lot of examples. But for us, so we're thinking about that. And we're like, well, yeah, of course, we want to respect, organizational boundaries, of course, and pull in and structure the way that people can see each other, as per organizational preferences. But as Margaret mentioned, like we're a people first platform, right? So if I'm in engineering and I need to have meetings with somebody in sales because I want that feedback in terms of what a customer is saying. It would be highly beneficial for me to like understand that person I'm meeting with, and highly beneficial for them to understand me, so that we can be much more productive. Maybe they're much more data driven than I am, so I should adjust accordingly, et cetera, et cetera. So, what we thought is like let's have role based access control respecting the organization, but as that final layer, let's put that final decision in the hands of the two individuals. So, if I wanted to connect with my counterpart in sales and they want to connect with me, that should override the RBAC boundaries at that point, because we want to encourage those interactions. So that's where we've, I say, put a twist on sort of more of that traditional segregation of visibility by putting it in the hands of the individual.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I kind of want to segue this into like user concerns. So if a user is concerned about privacy, you mentioned the example of giving people the power to opt out, right? The other example I think I have in my notes here is you allow folks to delete information. What sort of things were you thinking about, or things did you build in as part of, really being cognizant of what these concerns might be?
So our goal is, of course, to keep people at the platform and using Weethos to get the benefits from it. I mean, that's what we want, and that's what we're building for. But we also want to respect people's rights to remove themselves. So from those visibility settings, we also were like, well, okay, well, if they don't want to necessarily be visible to other people in their organization, there's certain areas of the product that wouldn't make sense to them. But what can we give them, in terms of individualized coaching, maybe without context of others and things like that? So we want to give like as much as we can while respecting that user's right to privacy, and I think we've achieved that. But equally, for those that want to remove themselves completely, we've set up a process where they're free to do so, and we remove all of that data. We also believe that because it's a people platform, that the user owns their data as well. So we also want to make it portable, because your natural work behaviors are really your natural work behaviors, whether you're in company A or company B. So being able to give user the rights to own their data and port it out from as they move companies was also kind of part of our design as well. But it goes back to that user-centric perspective of the user being in control.
Because they can use that information to better understand themselves and their working style so that it starts to benefit them, at least in that way, if not that kind of that broader view of how do I better collaborate with my peers and what are their working styles and that kind of thing. It's also understanding yourself. Yeah.
Exactly.
One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is expectations, like your users' expectations. Obviously, some of your users are like you, some your customers, right? Like the organizations that buy the product, and then the users who are the individuals, the employees who are using the product. What are their expectations? And that plays a huge role in security and privacy, even if we would prefer not to think that way. It's easier not to think about that way, right? It's easier to just think confidentiality, integrity, availability, like that's what security is. But it's kind of tangled in that human piece. I don't know, Margaret, I feel like you probably have something to say around this as well. So I'd be curious, like from your background as a psychologist and in human factors, like what you think about that.
Yeah, people come with a lot of baggage, I would say.
Yeah.
People have had a lot of strange experiences with their digital lives and their data. They've had a range of experiences in workplace culture. A lot have experienced damaged trust with organizations and sort of like a breakdown of expected psychological contracts. So, I believe that you value me in this way. I guess not. There's been a lot of churn in the corporate world recently with layoffs and restructures and, a whole slew of new technologies like this AI insanity. And so I think a lot of people are feeling a little bit reserved. And we should expect them to feel a little bit reserved. There are plenty of people who are early adopters and like, I'm going to go for it. But there's a little bit of hesitancy right now in saying, like, I'm all in, show my data, I'm working with people, I want my team to see me. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think can be quite a good thing. But expectations on privacy are damaged. Expectations on data handling habits from vendors are damaged. Trust between employees and their organization are also damaged, given just the things that we've seen occur in the past, 5 or 10 years. So,
How does your team account for those expectations, and how does that translate into the user experience?
I think the product itself is sort of set up to help repair things. Like I really believe in human connection, and this tool allows people to see each other more clearly and see where you are and understand that, like, you know what? It's not Darren being in my way. It's that Darren and I think about this differently. He's not my roadblock. We actually are complementary in our team on making something work. So ultimately, like, I believe this tool is something that can help repair on the human to human and company level those types of issues that we see in the workplace right now in workplace culture. But it is an enormous responsibility when you're building a product to know that people can't take any more mistakes with their data. People can't handle it. People can't cope with that, having their information spilled out or shared or something embarrassing coming out. And so it's really something that can't be secondary. I think helping people realize that it's not secondary to us as a company will help us overcome some of those challenges in, historical issues that have occurred with people-centric platforms.
Well, one of the things, it was around trust, right? Like building that trust, not having users' trusts violated. You can't actually, hold folks' hands as they're going through the product and reassure them, right? Like it's not, that's something that the user experience has to do. It has to communicate that somehow. I'm curious if you made any user, if you intentionally made some user experience decisions to help foster that trust and what examples of those might be.
Darren, I think about like just how transparent things are. Like, we really try to reduce this like gap. Like, we really don't want you to have to work really hard to understand the value that you get from the product that involves your data. So, if there's something that you responded to or something that you did, you should be seeing the value of that, not just like somewhere having some, data dump about you. It really is a value-driven data use that we try to maintain a high degree of transparency about. And Darren, I don't know, you probably have other thoughts on that.
No, I think that's a terrific point. And like through the user experience, like we want to cater for, people's level of trust. I think Margaret encompassed it really, really well with what she was saying there about, people's trust and technology. So again, going back to some of those like early architectural decisions, particularly around, being able to feature flag everything. I mean, we're doing some pretty advanced stuff here that, we think that a huge amount of people are going to get a lot of benefit from, but we also know that some aren't ready for everything. So being able to dial those up, and Heidi, I think it was a great statement, is like, how do we handhold people kind of through that journey is, we can give them a way to get a little bit here. And then when they kind of get comfortable with that and they see the value, to maybe turn on the next series of features. Like maybe they can get into the team side of things, but just with a confined set of people, like their actual teammates rather than organizational wide. So, we allow that level of control. Our philosophy is and always will be that, Ethos works better when everybody can interact with everybody and can see everybody. Like that is by far the best experience. But some organizations are not ready for that, and some people are not ready for that, but they are ready for elements of it. So our ability to turn things on and off based on either organizational preference or user preference, I think is going to help rebuild that trust with technology that Margaret was very eloquently talking about.
You highlighted a few places where I think it would really help UX designers to hear exactly what you did and like where it surfaced in the user experience. So you talked about, so Margaret said transparency, which I think it's like ding, ding, ding. Like, yes, that's the magical word, right? Is transparency. The other one that you said, Darren, was control. Giving the users a sense of control.
We give users a really great way, and this is where we recommend they start with the product, learning about themselves. So what we've built is anchored upon a psychometric and behavioral science that's been around, field tested for 20 or 30 years. And it was, kind of, one of those where you'd go and have like an offsite somewhere, somebody would come in and coach you and the team on different styles and working together. So think of that as the
Oh, you
basis.
mean I
Great.
never have to go to one of those again? Sounds amazing.
Yeah, so there we go. All right. So now like you can kind of learn about that without needing to go to one of those, learn about yourselves, right? And then you can open up the aperture a little bit, and maybe you want to learn about your team, right? So how best you work with your team, or how best you work with an individual teammate, which is great. We can provide some really, really deep insights into that. But the next layer where we really start to scale this out is leveraging AI to overlay any given work scenario with that. So, I'm working with Heidi and we've got to build a boat. Well, what is it that we should do? Like based on like Heidi's skills and Wethos style as we call it, and the team chemistry, like who should do what here, for example. So that's
Step one, find another partner.
right. Maybe that's it. But in order to scale that up for you to be able to get coaching on absolutely anything in that workplace relies on AI to scale that science. Right. Now, a lot of people are ready for that step, but some aren't. So like that's kind of the dials, if you were on that journey, where you can choose like what are you comfortable with? Because there's a huge amount of benefit in getting very detailed insights and coaching on a very specific thing. Like maybe it's a difficult conversation at work. Maybe you want to ask for a raise. Or maybe you need to figure out the best team to brainstorm the new rocket ship that you want to build. Like anything.
Ah, yeah, you're touching on some really important stuff. Yeah, so if I was concerned about like how do I ask for a raise? I don't necessarily maybe want my boss seeing what I'm asking. Like, how do you address those types of concerns?
Yeah, so we keep those conversational elements with what we call the Wethos Copilot private to the user, right? So we, internally and maybe externally in the future, but we refer to it as that trusted teammate, right? That person on your team where you've had like a hard day or you've got to do something you're not sure about, that first person you call to say, hey, like, what about this? Or, I've got this meeting coming up with this person. I'm not too sure how to pitch it. But keeping those conversations private is absolutely key, just both, philosophically, but also to encourage adoption. And we've seen that actually with one of the organizations that we were working with, that they saw a much broader increased adoption when they explicitly put out a statement saying, we're not looking at any of this stuff. And then all of a sudden that unlocked people to be able to use it and start getting those benefits. So, I mean, that's
I like
absolutely.
how you personified like that confidant at work and thinking about it from that perspective. It's funny because in my book, I give the place where the security user experience services and impacts the user experience a name, Charlie. So it's kind it resonates with me. Like for your product team to think of it that way, like your product is that confidant, is that person at work that you would turn
Exactly.
to who you know is not going to turn around and go tell everybody else what's going, what you just said to them. So I think that's really important. I know it sounds kind of silly, but I think it is important for teams to think about it that way, because that is what your users expect. Like, kind of going full circle. This is great. This is really helpful for UX designers who maybe have, maybe it's just an assumption, it's not actual reality, but they feel like they can't collaborate with their cross-disciplinary teams, product security, engineering. They just kind of feel blocked from doing that, especially around the security user experience. Maybe they think, I don't have the words to explain, or this isn't my problem. Like, what sort of questions can they ask, and how can they make that process more collaborative so you can get to those solutions faster?
I think part of it is showing it, right? That oftentimes the trap that we fall into is, oh, that's a horrible user experience, or it has to be that way. But actually, just playing it out as a user, like if you can kind of park sort of the preconceived ideas at the door and just say, let's just look at it and see if it passes our sniff test. And if it's a little clunky and it's like, why was that 4 clicks, or why was I blocked from doing it? Just talking it out. But I think getting, in a room, if that's possible, but if not virtually, and just be a customer. Like take kind of both hats off and be a customer, and don't be afraid to say it sucks. Because do you know what? You can fix it if it does. And there will be a thousand reasons why you've ended up where you've ended up, and oftentimes it's not that productive to go and revisit all of those. But if you can kind of come to the table and go, like, we are where we are, and is this something that I would want to use? And if the answer is no, then work together collaboratively to fix it. But actually using it, which is what a lot of people do, actually using the product that you're building is absolutely key to that, because oftentimes we're so kind of in the details that we lose sight of actually being a user, and you should enjoy your product.
Yeah, 37 Signals, the folks that make Basecamp, I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're big proponents of that. Like they use the products that they build. And the other thing that you said that resonated with me is like just pretend that you are your customer, go through it. If you have to, like if the only way to share it is to, you could take a video, you could take all the screenshots of every single step they have to go through, even just creating a flow chart of being like, this is literally my hands going around and like looking at the different pieces of the flow chart. There's 30 different steps for them to complete this, this thing. It takes all these different, to reset their password or, to do all of these things. Just showing people that really drives home your point. All right. Well, thank you both. This has been an amazing conversation. I'm really excited for both of you and for Mythos. I can't wait to see what comes next.
Us too.
Yeah,
Yeah.
thanks for having
And
us.
yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's been terrific. We really appreciate it.